Welcome to the January Monthly Policy Update. I'm Micah Nelson with Independent Sector. Today, I'm joined by my IF colleagues, Ben Kershaw and Ana Montanez, as well as Wes Coulomb with Washington Council Ernst & Young. Before we get into today's agenda, I want to go over a few housekeeping details. As part of our conference call feature, all lines are currently muted, and we will pause periodically for questions. To ask a question, you will need to unmute yourself by pressing star 6. We ask that when you are done, you mute yourself again by pressing star 6. For technical difficulties, please email publicpolicy@independentsector.org. We look forward to your questions today and appreciate your attendance.
Thank you, Micah. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the January Monthly Policy Update. As Micah noted, we are really fortunate in the independent sector community that we can often turn to our colleagues at Washington Council Ernst & Young for breaking up-to-the-minute policy intel from Capitol Hill. Usually, they're calling in to us, we imagine, from some secure room in the Capitol, you know, after leaving an all-senators meeting. We are really fortunate that today, in the room with us today, we have Wes Coulomb himself. So I'm really excited to have you here with us in the flesh over the phone for this monthly policy update. Wes, we're in a new year. You know, Congress had a pretty productive end of the year crush last year. What's the latest state of play that people in the charitable sector should be looking at on Capitol Hill and with the administration?
Yeah, well, thanks, Ben. Kind of looking back at last year, as you note, they did have, you know, kind of touch and go there, but did kind of towards the end of the session there in late December, they did come to terms with a large agreement on the budget issues, a large spending package for the fiscal year 2020, as well as a tax package to go along with that spending package. And so they got those done, you know, pretty much across the board. They followed the higher spending numbers they agreed to earlier last year, which kind of gave them the roadmap to finalize the appropriations package. And so I think there was, you know, on both sides of the aisle, strong bipartisan votes for that package on the spending side, which has increases in many areas that both Republicans and Democrats were for, the spending side and on the defense side and the non-defense spending side, and also a tax package that went along with that I think people are aware of that had some wins, big wins in there for the charitable sector, namely on the UBIT parking transportation fringe benefit repeal piece, as well as the simplification of the excise tax for private foundations. There's also a pension package that went along with that and some other tax items as well, that bigger package extenders that were done. One thing to note is that the extender package was just done through the end of 2020. Some of the items were done for longer term, but most of them were just done for 1 year going forward. Some years going back, but only 1 year going forward. So that'll give another trigger point for tax legislation be talked about later this year. Possibly into also into the next year. So that kind of sets the stage for what they're going to do for this year. As you know, it's election year. The campaigns are now in full swing for 2020, looking towards November. The presidential candidates are out on the campaign trail for the most part, and also the House is up for election, and a third of the Senate. So people are watching those races quite closely. So what is the House and the Senate going to do in the short term? Well, on the House side, they've been processing several pieces of legislation. This week, they did some war powers resolutions, getting at President Trump's ability, namely towards Iran. They also, you know, processed other legislation going forward on the financial services side. And we're not sure what they're going to do you know, next week. But the Senate is mostly focused and tied up on the impeachment trial. That's looking like it could potentially wrap up by the end of this week. Looking like the Republicans have the votes to not call witnesses for that trial. They are in the period of questions from senators that the Chief Justice is asking of both sides, both counsel for each side. That should wrap up, I think, tonight into tomorrow, and then potentially have further debate and then vote on witnesses. If that fails, they could move potentially to actually have votes on the articles of impeachment themselves by the end of the week. Saturday. So we'll see how that plays out, what direction it turns, but kind of seems to be kind of where it's going at the moment. It could turn a different direction, but that's kind of where we see it happening. So it's tied up the Senate for the most part the last couple of weeks. And when they finish with the impeachment trial, I think they'll kind of move back to you know, confirming judges and administration nominations and so forth in the Senate. And then what's on the tap going forward? We have the president is going to have a State of the Union address on February 4th, and then his administration's budget is going to be released on February 10th. And so that will kind of contain his policy proposals and the spending and the tax side. I'd imagine, thinking on the budget side, it will be like it has been in the past, with a whole lot of new changes to it. As you know, the president has tried to cut spending in various areas and cut certain programs out. I think that we've seen what happened in the last couple of years is that's been mostly ignored by Congress. They've set other higher spending limits, and the president's gone along with that, as we saw in December. So that's probably going to repeat itself. But, you know, we'll see what he puts in his budget for this next fiscal year and how that plays out. They'll trigger a series of hearings in the House and Senate committees with the various cabinet officials, Secretary Mnuchin on the Treasury side, with the Ways and Means and Finance Committee, for example. In those committees talk about the president's budget proposals and various policy topics. Going more down details, you have this House Ways and Means Committee doing some tax hearings this week. The Senate Finance Committee has not been able to do anything because when the Senate's in session or in impeachment session, they cannot do any committee business, and so they've been kind of tied up with that. So we'll see what they do going forward, but no announcements on the Finance Committee side, for example, for hearings or other activities going forward. But the House Ways and Means Committee has been active. And this week they had two hearings of note, one on paid family and medical leave, various proposals there to expand benefits and tax credits, for example, for employers to give their employees paid family leave. There's support for the policy. The question is, how far do you go? Democrats want to have a much more robust federal policy and a much more generous tax credit for family leave. Republicans are for it, but are not as supportive of a broad, expensive, refundable tax credit type proposal that the Democrats want to do. So that's been talked about this week in the Ways and Means Committee. They also have an issue with infrastructure, that hearing in the Ways and Means Committee on infrastructure proposals. We also saw this week the Democrats come out with, the House Democrats came out with a proposal to put forth a broad infrastructure spending package. The Highway Trust Fund authorization expires September 30th of this year, and so that is a trigger point for them to act on a highway package or infrastructure bill. The Highway Trust Fund itself does not expire. The funding does not run out until, I think, the summer of 2021, so there's time for them to act. They could just do a temporary extension. And my sense is that, given the politics of the campaign, they could end up just punting that highway extension into next year or to the end of this year and deal with it later. But there's going to be a lot of talk about infrastructure spending and different projects and so forth through the course of this year on that issue.
So let me ask you about that, Wes. So you mentioned that there'll be a fair amount of conversation on infrastructure. This is an area where I think a lot of people looked and saw potential for a bipartisan deal, especially with the Trump administration's rhetoric on infrastructure investment. We just saw them hand the president a victory, or agree to give the president a victory on North American free trade agreement renegotiation. Mm-hmm. Is there any way that there are, moderate Dems in tough districts in the House and the president, sort of the same coalition that came together on trade, might find some shared priorities on infrastructure this year?
Possibly, but not likely.
All right.
I think that, my experience, the highway spending package has always been very bipartisan. Both sides want to spend money on roads and bridges and so forth. The real question is how much and what amount. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee last year put out their infrastructure bill and highway bill. I think about $100 billion or so was the cost for that package. Compared to the Democrats in the House, put forth a proposal this week about $600 billion in cost. So there's a difference in magnitude, in scope of the two sides, but there is bipartisan support for doing something and doing something of a decent size. The real question is, how do you pay for it? That's always been the rub, is is do you raise the gas tax, which currently funds the Highway Trust Fund? Do you reach into other areas for tax funding? So that's going to be the issue in order to do in a big package. And I think that the way the environment is this year in a campaign year, it's going to be hard for me to see them come together between the two sides on a sizable package. But, you know, I could be surprised.
And see.
But I don't see it kind of lined up quite yet to get done this year.
Pre-election.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. You also noted the Senate Finance Committee can't meet, but I understand they have continued to try to engage in some nonprofit sector oversight even without being able to meet in person.
Yeah, the activity committee, you know, is ongoing, especially from the staff level, even though they're not having formal meetings of the members. And as we might have reported before, the Finance Committee oversight investigative staff has been examining conservation easement transactions to go after what they view as, you know, promoters and some loopholes in the conservation easement law. That investigation is ongoing. I think they actually put out some more subpoenas to some folks this week as part of that activity. So we see, you know, that is kind of ongoing, unclear when that will come to resolution.
Yeah.
I think it's, Chairman Grassley, as the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, is terming it out at the end of this year. So I would imagine it's going to wrap up sometime this year. It could be within the next several months. I think there's a sense of wanting to get that finished and get that going forward. So they're still working on issues like that in the committee from a staff level, and that's kind of that is ongoing.
Okay. Yep. Thank you. So why don't we pause here and give folks a chance to offer any questions about what you've heard so far from Wes. Reminder, it is *6 to unmute your lines. Okay, great. So thank you very much, Wes. I can tell that our audience is really excited to get to our special guest today. We are confronting a highly specialized but also a really important issue for the nonprofit sector in the Postal Regulatory Commission. And so we're really glad, I do believe he's on the line, to have Steve Kearney with the Alliance of Nonprofit Mailers joining us to give a brief update on that issue. And before I let Steve take it away, I'll just note he's been at the Alliance as the Executive Director since 2014. And before that, he had a long and illustrious career in federal government, mostly as a senior executive with the U.S. Postal Service. He led several functions there, including treasury, pricing, classification, customer relations, business development. So like a lot of great policy experts, he knows this agency inside. Steve, thank you for being with us today. Can you give us the latest on the Postal Regulatory Commission proposal?
Yeah, thank you, Ben. Hi, everybody. Thanks for inviting me. What we can do now is we can send comments to the PRC by February 3rd, next Monday, and I'll tell you about that before we finish. The background is that in 2006, a new law was passed about the Postal Service, and the main thing it did was limit price increases on postage to the Consumer Price Index for each class of mail, first class, marketing, and periodicals. And we've been operating under that since. The law also said that the regulator had to review it in 10 years. So that review started December 2016. They received comments. The PRC made its first proposal December 2017. We all made comments in early 2018, and they basically have sat on it since then because they got so much opposition and they were not sure they had enough votes among the commissioners there. Now they have three new commissioners and they're very confident that they have the votes. So they reintroduced a second proposal December 2019, and that's what we're trying to oppose now. The first one added three layers of surcharges on top of the CPI. This one does that also, but makes it more complicated with formulas trying to make it look scientific. The first one, we told everybody you could expect a cumulative increase in your postage rates of a range of 28 to 40% over the succeeding 5 years. 28 is applicable to letter-shaped mail. 40% would be for flat-shaped mail, including periodicals. The new formulas are similar in size, but they could go even higher. And they have really bad implications. Like one of the formulas is based on the density of mail. So in other words, the more mail volume goes down going forward, the more the Postal Service would be allowed to raise rates. Another part of it is based on their employee retirement obligations, which is a built-in cost that's already been supposedly covered by previous rate increases, but now they want to be made whole. And they would get another 1% for simply increasing their productivity measurement every year and meeting their service standards. So it's a really bad policy. In a lot of ways, it goes in the opposite direction of what price cap regulation should be. But the bottom line for our members, and I'm sure most nonprofits that rely on mail, is that this would be a huge cost increase, and really for a lot of us make it prohibitive to use mail at all in the future. The Postal Service and the regulator are hanging their hat on the fact that we had a temporary rate surcharge back in 2014 through 2016. It only lasted about a year and a half. It was an extra 4.3%. It gave the Postal Service $4.6 billion in extra revenue. So they're saying, well, that didn't kill our mail volume, so this new one shouldn't either. But there's a huge difference in size and duration, because that was temporary, so it had a value of $4.6 billion. This one is perpetual and cumulative, so we've estimated, or we've calculated, the net present value or cost of that is over $200 billion to mailers. So if you wanted to fund it all now, you'd have to set aside $200 billion for all mailers to pay for it in the future. So we're encouraging nonprofits to write letters. Well over 30 have already had them posted. The website is prc.gov. And if you go there and click on active cases, and you'll see this case, and this is the key docket number you need to include in your letter. It's R as in Robert, M as in Mary, 2017-3. So if you look for RM 2017-3 and click on that, then you can click on comments and you can see many, many examples of other letters that people have already written and have already been posted. And I gave Ben a call to action a couple of weeks ago. The easiest way to do it is just to send a letter in the mail to them at the address in that call to action. I'll stop there to see what questions anybody has.
Thank you very much, Steve. And we did include information about this in the DC download column that Anna writes. That went out in our newsletter yesterday.
This is Harvey Dale, and I have a question. Now, my question is, how does this interact with other forms of delivery of messages such as UPS, FedEx, email, text, etc.?
Well, it's interesting. That's a great question. The Postal Service has a legal monopoly over the delivery of hard copy mail to our mailboxes. So in one sense, they have a very strong monopoly, and a lot of nonprofits rely on postal mail to raise a lot of their money and to send their magazines and newsletters. But there are a lot of alternatives to that now, including email and internet and social media and all kinds of digital alternatives. So people will have to look at switching more of their activity to digital if they're faced with price increases like this. On the other hand, the delivery of packages that you mentioned, like FedEx, UPS, Amazon, others, the Postal Service participates in that market, and they're a big player in that market. And it's in our interest as senders of letter mail and flat mail that they do well in the package business, because that provides them more revenue to help fund their network. But at the same time, they depend on the letter mail and the flat mail to keep their network going so that they compete in the package business. So it's kind of a symbiotic relationship. This type of price increase on the mail side would not affect the package side, because it does not have a monopoly like the mail side. But it would drive so much volume out that it would damage the Postal Service irreparably, and it would hurt many segments of our economy, especially rural areas that still rely heavily on mail. For example, one of our members is rural electric cooperatives that exist in every state. There are over 900 of them. They rely heavily on mail to send their magazines with important information about their electricity and safety and local news, but they also send bills and statements and get their payments back through the mail. So if they're faced with an increase like this, they will have to raise their rates for electricity just to cover their postage. That's just one of many examples that are already posted up there. I would suggest if anybody wants to write a comment that you really just focus on mail is really important to my mission. Here's what my mission is. Here's how much I use mail for, maybe how much I spend on it. And an increase like this would cause us to just reach a tipping point and have to make strategic decisions to move our activity away from postal mail, and also hurt our mission of our organization.
Thank you, Steve and Harvey. Other questions for Steve? Steve, I would just highlight something that you noted. Even as a policy person myself, when I hear, comments on a regulatory proposal, I tend to think of, needing to be technical and, master postalese in order to really make an impact. But you're saying that this is more about, telling the organization's story and just the impact on that one organization.
Right, exactly right, Ben. We're going to write postalese, like 100 pages of it or more, with expert witnesses. But if you look at the examples that are on there, I think we sent 3 examples with our call to action. They are short letters, usually 1 page, and they're really important. I know the 5 commissioners, they tell me that kind of thing really influences what they do. And we will cite this in our own filing. It'll be part of the official record, and it's possible that the commission will plow ahead and allow the Postal Service to start raising rates later this year. So you could see 5-8% rate increases later in 2020, the first of 5 years, and we would have to appeal it to the U.S. Court of Appeals and apply for a stay, but the chances of getting a stay are very low. It's very difficult to get. So the worst case scenario is that the court would take 1, 2 or more years to make their final decision. And in the meantime, the rule would go into effect and the Postal Service would have these massive rate increases for a couple of years, maybe. So your letters are part of the record, both at the regulator and in the U.S. Court of Appeals, if you write something.
Got it. Thank you very much, Steve. We are really grateful to you, Steve, and to the Alliance of Nonprofit Mailers for your work on this issue and your partnership with Independent Sector and its members on this issue. Again, if people want more info, you know, Steve's website or the quick snapshot from the DC download are great places to start. You're always also welcome to reach out to IS staff directly. Thank you again, Steve. Next You're up, welcome. We have a few updates from the independent sector side. Anna has an update on a ever-evolving and pressing issue.
Yes, thank you, Ben. I have an update regarding the sale of the public interest registry. So a group of leaders and members of the nonprofit sector recently came together to create a co-op organization to block the sale of the public interest registry, PIR, which is the company that owns every .org domain on the web, to the private equity firms Ethos Capital. The new organization named Cooperative Corporation of .org Registrants seeks to convince the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICANN, to block the sale of the nonprofit PIR. The nonprofit community, as you heard from us last December, is very worried that the PIR purchase could bring increases in the domain prices, particularly with the possibility of eliminating the cap on these domain prices. Last year, Independent Sector joined other organizations in expressing opposition to this deal, and we encourage you, if you haven't, to sign onto the campaign that we mentioned last December, but that it's also referenced within the DC download for January, just to voice your concern and to see if the sale could be blocked, right? Or just to raise your concerns.
Great, thank you, Anna. And then I have a couple more updates for folks before we will pause again for questions and comments. This update is on as Wes mentioned, the retroactive repeal of the parking and transit tax through UBIT. The IRS has provided much needed guidance for nonprofit organizations that paid this tax and are owed refunds. In issuing these instructions, the IRS has fulfilled requests that was made in writing by Chairman Neal and Oversight Subcommittee Chairman Lewis from the House Ways and Means Committee. Also fulfilled a request made by Independent Sector ourselves in person at the IRS a couple weeks ago. We will leave it to you, dear listeners, to determine which of those requests really pushed this across the finish line. But we're really glad that that information is out. Another update is from earlier this week. On Monday, the Supreme Court issued a 5-4 decision allowing the Trump administration to begin enforcing and implementing its public charge regulations. You all will remember that in August, the Homeland Security Department announced it would expand the definition of a public charge, which is a definition used to assess the immigration status of people in the United States or seeking entry to the United States. This is a definition that had never been formally defined, and the Department of Homeland Security is proposing to step into that void and add many non-cash benefits, such as public programs, to that definition. As we've reported, and as many others have said before, this is of concern for the nonprofit community, hopefully because it impacts the people that we serve, and anything that impacts our communities is something that concerns the nonprofit sector. It also has the potential to put nonprofit organizations and their employees in very difficult positions as people who need services consider whether to accept those services because it might impact their immigration status. This proposal the Trump administration does now have the ability to put it into effect. It had been blocked after a federal judge in New York imposed a nationwide injunction after a lawsuit from a number of states. I will note that there are, you know, districts, there are federal appeals courts that have come to the opposite conclusion, and so this matter will still work its way through the federal courts, but as a result of the Supreme Court decision, that the Trump administration does have the authority to implement these regulations now. So why don't we pause there? Questions about the .org issue, about IRS instructions on UBIT, about the public charge regulations?
Hi, this is Regina from Council of Michigan Foundations. No questions, but just a quick comment. So Council of Michigan Foundations, our public policy committee, did take a position on the .org or the public interest registry. So I just wanted to lift that up and willing to and ready to kind of identify ways to engage and to assist on that particular issue. And then the other thing specific to public charge, I'm really glad that you all are following that and that you've lifted up kind of the Supreme Court decision that allows Trump to move forward with enforcement of the regulation. It's something that obviously we've been watching here in Michigan very carefully. So thank you for monitoring that and lifting it up for this group.
We appreciate that, Regina. Thank you, as always. One thing I would just flag again, because Regina mentioned it, is that their independent sector was one of the 26 or so organizations that signed an initial letter opposing sale of .org, and others can add their names to that letter at save.org.org. Other questions, comments? Thank you all very much for joining us this January day. We look forward to speaking with you all same day, same time next month, and working with you in the meantime. Have a great afternoon, everyone.